Everybody, my name's Tony Giddens, Director of the LSE. On behalf of the school, let me welcome everyone here tonight and welcome especially our distinguished guest. The lecture tonight is being given in memory of Justice Dora Patel, who died almost 2 years ago in March 1997. I would like to welcome the members of his family who are with us this evening and just say a few words about Justice Patel before introducing our speaker, Ambassador Thomas Hammerberg. The Patel family have very generously funded this memorial lecture, which is a key part of a major human rights program we are planning to develop in the London School of Economics. Dora Patel, who read law at University of Bombay, graduated from the LSE in 1949 with a BSc in Economics. Justice Patel was also made an honorary fellow of the school in 1990. An honorary fellowship is in effect an LSE honorary degree. Justice Patel was an eminent jurist, deeply respected in his own country, Pakistan, and in South Asia as a whole for his intellect, humanism, and integrity. In 1981, when acting Chief Justice of the Pakistani Supreme Court, he refused to take an oath of allegiance to the military regime and resigned from the court. While serving on the court, he was responsible for several landmark judgments. After stepping down from the court, he became ever more active in promoting human rights and social justice. He helped to found the Pakistan section of Amnesty International. He was a member of the International Commission of Jurists. In 1986, he helped establish the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, which he continued to serve and to guide for many years. Under his chairmanship, the commission became the most potent force for justice and defense of human rights in Pakistan. Justice Patel was also active on many fronts outside of the country, including at the United Nations and through the Pakistan-India People's Forum for Peace and Democracy. He was an elegant and passionate writer with an impressive command over a variety of subjects. He wrote eloquently about freedom of expression, religious and racial intolerance, economic injustice, the vital importance of an independent judiciary, the burden of foreign debt, often incurred through the purchase of arms. He was critical of the World Bank and the IMF's insistence on reorganizing the economies of Africa and Asia through structural adjustment. He felt that these policies often served to wipe out infant industries in the developing countries, leaving them more impoverished and often benefiting the developed rather than developing countries. This lecture, in Justice Patel's memory, will be the first in a series of public lectures and events on critical issues in human rights, which the school will be organizing in our series called Spanning the Centuries. There will be 6 or 7 such lectures to follow. This, in turn, is part of a larger project now underway, to which I referred earlier, to integrate and expand teaching and research in human rights within the LSE, as well as to explore how we might most effectively contribute to policy formation and public debate in this area. I have a very strong personal commitment to this program and an involvement in it. I have much pleasure in welcoming Ambassador Hammerberg as Dora Patel lecturer. Thomas Hammerberg is a graduate of the Stockholm School of Economics. As a journalist and writer on ethical and human rights issues, he is a much respected figure internationally. And I notice there are many of his friends in the audience today. He will be also known to many people from the time when he was in London, serving as Secretary General of Amnesty International here in London, having previously chaired its International Executive Committee for several years. He returned to Sweden in the mid-1980s to direct the Swedish Save the Children. He also served on the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child as member and vice chair from its beginning in 1992 until 1997. Under his stewardship, the committee developed into the most dynamic and effective of the UN treaty bodies. Pakistan was among the countries he visited in the effort to get governments to comply with their obligations under the convention. Britain too, in fact. Thomas Hammarberg is now ambassador and special advisor to the Swedish government on human rights and humanitarian issues. He is also, as many people in the audience will know, the special representative of the United Nations Secretary General for Human Rights in Cambodia, and he has just recently returned from that country. He will be speaking tonight on principles and politics of human rights, and I'm very happy, pleased, and honoured to welcome him to the school tonight. Ambassador Hammarberg.
Thank you, Professor Giddens. I will actually later say something about the relationship between the third way and human rights, but you will have to wait a little bit on that one. It's true that, as you said, that there are many friends here, experts and activists on human rights, from whom I have learned a lot, and I would actually prefer to listen to you rather than taking so much time myself here. Of course, I would have liked most to listen to Dora Boutelle, and I will start with a quote of his, which I think is important. He said, "There are times when there is a duty to speak. Those who are silent on such occasions are guilty." This idea came over and over again in his writings and his lectures, and it did influence his own life profoundly. Silence would have made him Chief Justice of Pakistan, a very prestigious position, but he chose to speak out against the military law regime at that time. I think through this action and this statement, he touched on a very crucial element of human rights, the importance of making a distinction between right and wrong, and the necessity, moral obligation, to take a position. For him, this was a matter of principle. I assume to the military ruler of Pakistan, it was an act of political opposition. That in particular, as Dora Boutelle set an example for others. In fact, human rights advocacy has had a deep impact on the political scene during the second half of this century. It has contributed to decolonization, the breakdown of Soviet communism, the breakdown of apartheid. And if you study the political agenda in a number of countries, you see that human rights matters are today high on the agenda. This is not surprising, because human rights deal with essential matters essential to ordinary people. Sometimes controversial matters, of course. The language of human rights has infiltrated the political debate, sometimes also to the detriment of the human rights cause itself. And during the Cold War, human rights, of course, became a propaganda weapon on both sides. This clear recognition that human rights are politically significant has, of course, been welcomed by human rights activists like Dora Boutelle. At the same time, this politicization of human rights is a concern. There is a clear apolitical element in the approach of organizations like the Commission on Human Rights in Pakistan or Amnesty International on an international level. They do recognize that they act within a political field, on the political scene, but they do strive at the same time to be non-partisan between political parties, between ideologies. And naturally, they are keen to protect the principled dimension of the human rights cause. Indeed, these advocates, and I belong to that group myself, argue that the principles of human rights stand above politics, and in that sense really ought not to be controversial. It would only be natural that they were supported by conservatives, liberals, socialists alike. And this, of course, comes close to defining human rights almost as a super ideology within a limited field, with specific aims like basic freedoms, security for the individual, and the possibility for subsistence. And the goals are also such for this super ideology that the methods of governing are restricted. But this approach cannot but raise the fundamental question about the very foundation, the grounding of human rights. Of course, today, very few people would accept that we have got human rights handed down to us by God, or that there are something like natural human rights, that they're based on natural law. The starting point must be that they have not been there from the beginning. They have had to be fought for, made legitimate, and when they have developed, to be further claimed and grounded. The Charter of the United Nations and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, were immediate responses to the widespread outrage at the time against Holocaust and other massive crimes. Those who drafted the Universal Declaration, they tried to draw from ethical principles of the world religions, as well as from socialist, liberal, and conservative, other secular thinking. They wanted this declaration, which was seen as so important already from the very start, to be based on common standards, common values, which could be related to the traditions all over the world. But the intention was not to establish a new philosophy or ideology. This package of human rights norms would not replace religions, political sympathies, or general views about the purpose of life. The articles were from the beginning seen as instrument for a particular purpose. And this approach, of course, makes it even more important to establish and build on a consensus for these principles of human rights. And of course, here there is a dilemma. Human rights is also supposed to have an effect on governing. And if you begin to criticize governments on the basis of those principles, they may not be so happy about belonging to this consensus themselves. And there is a dilemma here when it comes to criticizing and using the instrument of human rights and at the same time protecting the consensus. However, even within the context of the United Nations, human rights were supposed to be something more than just the common nominal denominator of government opinions, something more than that. And if you read the preamble of the Universal Declaration, it refers to the inherent dignity and the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family. Of course, this in itself doesn't give us the inalienable rights. But this declaration did start a process of international and national lawmaking, which has made by now human rights firmly rooted in law. However, there is another dimension than the legal one. The Universal Declaration presents rights as a common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations. And it refers in this preamble to the fact that the acts preceding the Universal Declaration, the crimes by the Nazi Germans, for instance, have outraged the conscience of mankind. And here is an idea about a common conscience and a structured learning from history, a sort of collective response to the previous atrocities. And this is a very important aspect of the whole human rights theory. If you compare with the drafters of the American Declaration of Independence, when they stated that all men are endowed with certain inalienable rights, they added, "We hold these truths to be self-evident. That term may not have convinced the skeptics, but I think it does point to a possible, though subjective, argument that human rights come with the fact that we are human beings, that we are recognized as human beings when we have our rights. And John Vincent, who is one of those who have inspired me perhaps most when it comes to thinking about human rights, he wrote that human rights are grounded in an appeal to our human nature. We have human rights by virtue of our humanity. For me, the strongest foundation for human rights is simply the fact that people want them. So obviously want them. This has been clear to me when working in Cambodia. I've traveled much in the provinces, talked with villagers on many occasions. And what becomes very clear is that basic justice and the possibility to complain if there are problems are so fundamental to each human being. And the fact that non-governmental organizations have grown up, being founded and developed in almost every country in the world today, I think springs out of the fact and is a reflection of the urgency and relevance of human rights today. Now, I'm convinced that if one could organize a global free referendum on human rights, whether they are important or not, whether we want them or not, there will be an overwhelming yes vote. And it's also clear that when one discusses as representatives of the non-governmental human rights community or governments working for human rights or the United Nations, that governments with which you discuss, they do not deny the fact that human rights are important and probably have an enormous support within their own country. It's sort of the basis for the discussion many times. This general sense that the idea of human rights is widely supported and therefore in a deeper sense legitimate gives the human rights cause a sort of moral authority. And this in turn has made political discussions on human rights, has given such discussions particular vibrations. Sometimes these discussions appear not to be so much about right and wrong, but about good and evil. And those governments who have been mentioned in United Nations discussions about human rights feel that they are put on a sort of blacklist. There is a shame connected to be criticized internationally when it comes to human rights violations today. On the other hand, those governments who do criticize others also run the risk here, because if they are not consistent, if they are not keen on human rights themselves at home, they run the risk of being seen as hypocritical. So much about the grounding of human rights. My next question is, what are actually the human rights? what are we talking about? I think there has been a confusion in the discussion about the very nature of human rights. What distinguishes human rights from other aspirations in the discussion? I would like to mention a couple of characteristics of human rights. First, human rights are about important matters, not anything. Ronald Dworkin talked about human rights as trumps, something especially important. And the dilemma, of course, is to draw the line. How much can the list of rights in the international standards be extended without undermining this concept of a priority list, rights being trumps? Secondly, human rights go beyond a charity approach. It's not only a question of satisfying needs. The fact that rights are rights makes them imperative. Human rights also protect the dignity of the individual. I have a quote of Alexis de Tocqueville, who said, "The idea of right removes from any request its supplicant character and places the one who claims it on the same level as the one who grants it." Three, human rights have an international dimension. Of course, it was immensely important that international law recognized the individual as subject of international law in terms of human rights. There is an element of international solidarity here. International protection of oppressed individuals who, precisely they are oppressed, may not have the national channels to object to the treatment. This principle of internationalism in human rights is now widely accepted, which is also illustrated by the July decision in Rome about a new international criminal court, and also reflected in the discussions here about Augusto Pinochet. The controversies about the principle of international responsibility is how that principle could be implemented in reality. The fourth characteristic: as a matter of principle, human rights apply to everyone. The Universal Declaration recognizes in the preamble the equal rights of all members of the human family, and several of the articles start, "everyone has a right to." In fact, equality is a major cornerstone in the human rights theory. This, in turn, has spurred discussions about women's rights, the rights of the child, rights of minorities and indigenous peoples, including about the need for proactive measures for such groups. Fifth characteristic: rights are held against someone, normally the government. If the individual is a subject of right, the right is not meaningful if no one is responsible for ensuring this right. There should be a correlative duty to someone, on someone, to ensure that the right can be enjoyed. And this is normally the state. Also here, there is a new and important, difficult discussion emerging for the moment about responsibilities also being placed on others. For instance, large corporations, organized political movements, even individuals, when they have the power to affect fundamentally the situation of individuals in a way that is close to human rights. So governments are landed with duties in relation to human rights. These duties are usually divided into three aspects. One, to protect people from violations. The first usually we mention is the obligation to respect the rights, not to interfere with the freedom of the individual. The second, to respect the rights and also to protect those rights when they are threatened by other people. And the third, to provide for the rights, for the fulfillment of the rights. All those are relevant to all the rights. However, there is a bit of a difference in the sense that the respecting of rights mainly are dominant when it comes to rights connected to not being interfered with when it comes to freedoms, what is called negative liberties. While there's more of a need for an active government stance protecting and providing when it comes to what has been termed as positive liberties, and of course rights which are related to economic and social standards. This, of course, deals with a political minefield, because we're here in a discussion about the role and the size of the state, the government. And this discussion is one of the most important ones for the moment when it comes also to human rights, and I will have to come back to it. Mary Robinson, the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva, has pointed at a couple of other characteristics for the human rights theory. She said that the fact that human rights are seen as universal is an achievement, that they apply irrespective of culture, religion, political opinions, they apply everywhere. And secondly, she said, it is important that the rights are seen as indivisible, that they are seen as part of the same whole, that they interrelate. She welcomed the broad recognition of those two principles, but in fact, these are not totally accepted by everyone. And in fact, the two principles are questioned in discussions which can be seen as semi-ideological, where it's not quite clear whether the criticism is based on genuine concern or whether they're used as smoke screens to avoid the discussion about implementation. But I think it is important to look at the arguments against the proposition that human rights apply universally, to look at the questions towards the idea that the whole package of human rights belong together and that they are in fact indivisible, but also to look on two other issues which have come up with some force recently. One relates to whether there are too much rights and should there not be also duties for the individuals. And finally, discussion about what has been termed as the right to development. All those four discussions have shaken the human rights community considerably during the last couple of years, and it could be worthwhile to make a quick comment on the discussions. First, about universality versus cultural specificity. The charge we hear is that human rights is a Western concept. And the fact that the UN has adopted norms about human rights is really only a consequence of bullying from the Western governments in international fora. After all, it has been said, the Universal Declaration in the first place was adopted only with 48 votes in a General Assembly which was much smaller than the General Assembly of today. It was in this spirit that Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad of Malaysia actually the other year proposed that the Universal Declaration should be rewritten from the very beginning. Other politicians and diplomats in Southeast Asia have argued that the international human rights standards promote an extreme individualism and deny the importance of the family and the community in the Asian societies. Others have said that rights and rules about morality must depend on the cultural context. And therefore, it does amount, I say, to cultural imperialism to impose one particular set of values and rules on other cultures. Yeah. This is really a challenge to the human rights theory as it has developed. The most effective response to this argument has come from voices within those societies themselves, people like Durab Patel. They have argued for cultural pluralism, yes. But they also shown that cultures and religions normally do support the human rights values. And then they have added, when cultural practices do derogate from such important principles, for instance, when it comes to the treatment of women, this should not be tolerated in the name of progress. In fact, they have built on the self-evident nature of human rights and the ethical authority of the human rights message. And they have asked why people in some countries and in some cultures must be satisfied with less freedom, less protection than people in other parts of the world. Why should it be more justified to torture and arbitrarily detain a Muslim or a Buddhist than a Christian, or vice versa? The Secretary General, Kofi Annan, has entered this discussion with some force. He said in a couple of speeches in the end of 1997, human rights are not alien to any country. They are inherent in all nations. Human rights are African rights. They are also Asian rights. They are European rights. They are American rights. They belong to no government. They are not limited to any continent. They are fundamental to humanity itself. Very close, actually, to John Vincent's thought. At the same time, several scholars and philosophers outside North America and Europe have gone back to their own cultural roots and tried to analyze whether there are connections between the previous thinking in those areas and the values expressed in the international human rights norms. Kim Dae-jung wrote an interesting article before he was made president of South Korea a couple of years ago, where he showed that the thought that there should be restraint on the ruler from the people actually surfaced in East Asian philosophy some 2,000 years before Locke, John Locke. Amartya Sen has gone through some of the South Asian thinkers, Buddha, emperors Ashoka, Akbar, and also shown that there is a clear element of such values in their teaching. And therefore, he cannot conclude that by the very nature of the human rights message, they are only based on Judeo-Christian tradition. Muslim scholars are trying to also see what in Islam can be connected directly to human rights thinking. This can be seen as a sort of a retroactive universalization of the human rights message. But the point is to show that the values which are there behind and backing the human rights message are not alien to those philosophies in various parts of the world. That's what they want to show, and I think they have done it. The next discussion is about duties and rights. And there the charge is that there's a lack of balance between the two in present-day life. one argument, and again it has come mainly from some politicians and diplomats in Southeast Asia, is that the exclusive insistence on rights could be divisive and lead to dispute and conflict in the society. This may sound almost like the known motto, no rights without responsibilities. But in fact, this is another discussion. It's not the same discussion. Of course, the human rights advocates, they have been skeptical about the message that there are too much human rights in the world today. And one reason, of course, is that they have seen governments, regimes, using the language of duty, obligation to justify suppression of human rights. People who have peacefully challenged corrupt autocratic policies have been portrayed as promoting instability, disturbing social order. This is a misuse of language, of course, and perhaps we should try to discuss more constructively than that. It's important to realize that when you study the international human rights norms, they are qualified. They are not absolute. The right to freedom of expression, for instance, does not allow a person to slander or libel someone else. The right to equality cannot be pursued to the point where it leads unfairly to someone else suffering inequality, etc. The rights, as they are expressed in international norms, have limitations, even put duties on people. But there are also, in the human rights international standards, some references to duties of the individual in a more general sense. If you go back to this document, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights itself, you find in the penultimate article the following: everyone has duties to the community in which alone the free and full development of his personality is possible. Everyone has duties. The problem has been that there hasn't been much discussion on how to interpret this, and that's why the discussion about the duties may be useful if it's channeled constructively. My point is that the Universal Declaration and international human rights agreements do cover many aspects of rights and duties, and there is a balance created there already. So if the proposal, which has been put forward by some former statesmen in the organization Interaction Council, about a separate parallel Universal Declaration on Human Responsibilities, if that proposal was adopted, you would in fact create a lack of balance, and you would create problems when it comes to how to interpret the one declaration as compared to the other when they cover the same areas, for instance, freedom of speech. Fortunately, it seems that this proposal is not carried through. But there is another important lesson to draw from this discussion about rights and duties, and that's that there is a longing for a more clear formulation of a global ethics. Several commissions, including this International Commission on Global Governance, which was chaired by the Swedish Prime Minister at the time, Ingvar Carlsson and Sonny Ramphal, asked for the formulation of some global ethics which would help regulating, for instance, the activities of large corporations in world affairs. We believe that that discussion is important, but it shouldn't be pursued so that the basic human rights that we have now agreement upon will be undermined. And in fact, if we talk about a global ethics, I'm convinced that those who have worked for human rights and the human rights community in general has a major contribution to give to that discussion. perhaps the most controversial discussion so far about human rights internationally has been on economic and social rights. Are they human rights? Are they as important as other human rights? Do they undermine the possibility of implementing civil and political rights? The questions have come mainly from representatives of the United States. The fact that economic and social rights were actually included from the very beginning in the first drafts of the Universal Declaration was partly a consequence of the speech given by President Roosevelt, 1941, his State of the Union speech, where he defined the four liberties, the four freedoms, where he included the freedom from want as one of those essential freedoms. Eleanor Roosevelt was very keen, even if the discussion had started in the United States at that time, that these rights should really not be put in, that they should be included. The French lawyer René Cassin also took the, who had an important role when it comes to formulation of the Declaration, also argued for the inclusion of economic and social rights. But as I said, this is a sensitive matter because it touches on the role of the state and the size of the government, an important matter in political discussion today. The response from the majority within the United Nations has been, yes, economic social rights are also important. And after that, the philosophy about the indivisibility of the rights has developed. Economic and social rights help the implementation of civil and political rights, and vice versa. They go together. They support one another. There is a dynamic interrelationship between the various types of rights. Amartya Sen, again, has shown through his studies the importance of freedom of speech when it comes to combating famine and starvation in South Asia. That's one linkage. Others have made clear that when economic and social rights are protected in society, it makes it easier also to have basic freedoms. I believe personally that this relationship between the various rights should not be seen as mechanic and automatic. But sufficient experience is there, based on studies like the one by Amartya Sen, to make a good case to say that the various types of rights, as now defined, is a package that is logical and that the various rights support one another. This is probably now the majority view within the governments in the world, and one would hope that the discussion would end there. The problem is that there have been important queries about how to implement these rights. Some people have argued that it's not possible to implement economic and social rights because they can't really be made into law. Others have said, well, these are problems of resources. How could you criticize the government for not implementing those rights if they can't afford? Those issues need further discussion. Of course, several of the economic and social rights have been legislated. The right to schooling, for instance, is part of the law in many countries. There's also an emphasis when it comes to legislation about economic social rights on the non-discrimination, the fact that the right to schooling, to health, to decent job relations, etc., should be implemented without discrimination, for instance, on the ground of gender, on the grounds of whether you're disabled or not, etc. That aspect, non-discrimination, has also been made law in many countries. But there are areas where legislation is not really appropriate. And we also know that when it comes to labor rights, for instance, very often the solution is better found through agreements between the parties in the labor market than through legislation. Other means of implementation of other economic social rights could be through political decision or administrative decision. Human rights need not necessarily be implemented through legislation. What about resources? Every human rights will in the end cost something, but it's true that some of the economic social rights are more expensive, for instance the right to education, and to ensure that every child has a right to go to school, than some of the other rights. Here the discussion becomes a bit complicated because the international norms allow for progressive implementation, a step, an incremental implementation. It also allows for a lower level of implementation from the very poor countries in comparison to the rich countries. This nuanced approach makes it more difficult to moralize about progress or not. But this problem has been, I think, usefully discussed within some of the international bodies monitoring implementation of human rights, mainly the Committee on Economic and Social Rights and the Committee on the Rights of the Child. And they have developed an approach where they would ask for every government who has ratified the conventions to at least ensure a minimum level of implementation and to take steps towards the full implementation with the available resources. I think if one is self-critical on the human rights side, one would admit that further discussions are needed to operationalize the implementation of economic and social rights. But to throw them out now, to cut them out of the international standards, which seems sometimes to be the position of the United States, would not be useful. It would be an offense against all the work done within the ILO since 80 years ago, where standards have been developed precisely on economic and social rights. And it would, of course, be a loss when it comes to the protection of people for whom economic and social rights are fundamentally important. There is a discussion about right to development, which is probably the most complicated one within the international community. That discussion also goes back to the Universal Declaration. In one article, 28, it said that everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which rights and freedoms set forth in the Declaration can be fully realized. Everyone is entitled to a social and international order. Of course, the correlative duty obligation here is not obvious. The concept has been discussed for years within the United Nations, but honestly, there is no clarity today about what right to development actually means. Well, one has agreed on some aspects. One is that the right to development includes the right of the individual to participate in development work. But I think we had that right even before. It includes, it said in UN resolutions, the right of everyone to enjoy all human rights. Well, that doesn't bring so much new elements either. It's also clear that this term right to development does not mean that poor countries have a contractual right to receive aid from the richer countries. Nor does it mean that development or lack of development can be invoked by a government as an excuse to justify human rights violations. So what remains? Well, of course there is a connection between development and human rights. And in fact, much of the development cooperation policy today aims at promoting human rights. In fact, one could argue that the purpose of that type of development is precisely to promote and ensure human rights, and all human rights. And of course, one could also argue that there is an importance of human rights in the development process itself. And development organizations have used terms like participation and empowerment to illustrate the need of human rights within the development process. The problem arises when the right to development as a right is presented on par with, for instance, the right not to be tortured, the right to speak out. It's not the same kind of right which regulates the relationship between the individual and the state, the government. It's a question of a relationship between government and other governments, or a government and the international community. And this raises the question on whether one could find a way to discuss factors which are important for the possibility of implementing human rights in an individual country. And there one is, of course, close to international economic relations, aid, but also trade and other economic relationships. And the point that the third world, the South countries, have tried to make is that these relationships do affect our possibilities to implement human rights. And they have a point there. And in my opinion, the Western governments and the international multilateral organizations still have to show some foresight when it comes to accepting that this is a problem, and such relationships do affect the possibilities of implementing human rights. When the Human Rights Commission under Eleanor Roosevelt was trying to plan for the human rights regime, they had in mind three steps. One was a declaration adopted, then a convention, ended up in two conventions, and the third project they had in mind was a document on the implementation of the rights. That never came. There was never a proposal and there was never a discussion. But my interpretation is that this discussion is now coming back through the back door. The need to discuss the possibilities to make reality of the rights, and the recognition that there are resource problems involved. So, these are some comments on the four major sort of semi-ideological discussions which have been held during the last years on human rights. I think the result of the discussion so far is indeed, at least within the majority, that universality as a principle and indivisibility, that rights go together, that principle, the two of them are confirmed. The discussions about economic and social rights and the discussions about duties and about right to development, those discussions are still polarized, still very politicized, but I believe that if the partners in that discussion care to listen to one another, that the analysis of the human rights theory may actually deepen, because there are some important points to learn from these discussions. So, where are we today when it comes to the political dimension of the human rights discussion? Human rights have been put on the agenda. In fact, human rights have begun to be related to other problems like development, protection of security and peace, protection of the environment, humanitarian problems. And within the United Nations, they talk about mainstreaming of human rights, that human rights should be an aspect of all the programs of the world organization. A sort of infiltration, penetration of human rights thinking into the other programs of the organization. that development is important in itself. But the real impact will depend on whether the efforts are really serious and whether the analysis of the world problems today actually do give room for the human rights factor. One could ask, what place has ethical consideration, human rights, when we are discussing the new economic scene and the consequences of the globalization on a local level? One could discuss what methods are actually legitimate when it comes to combating terrorism. One could ask if there is now a political readiness to act on serious warnings of massive violations, like the one we had in Rwanda some years ago, and a readiness to learn from mistakes so clearly made. This mainstreaming also goes on within governments, and not least within the foreign ministries. Human rights are said to be put at the heart of foreign policy. I assume the idea is that human rights will be treated as an aspect, a dimension of all parts of foreign policy, both bilateral and multilateral relations. In Sweden, we worked out a program, a plan on that type of mainstreaming put to the parliament for approval. To decide that human rights will be a major consideration in all foreign policy is actually a major undertaking. And it will be tested. It will be tested in concrete situations. What guarantees will be required in arms trade that sales will not result in human rights violations? What are the links, indeed, between trade and human rights? How can assistance cooperation be designed to support deprived people in repressed societies? Do we receive refugees even if many ask for asylum? How much of analysis of human rights consequences are we doing before supporting sanctions or even military operations against a particular country? Questions will also be raised about human rights at home, in our own backyard. There is a convenient tendency in both Europe and North America today to see human rights as a problem for other countries, not themselves. This somewhat complacent and patronizing attitude was, of course, prevalent during the Cold War, but it continues. And it undermines the international regime for human rights in reality. The fact that the United States does not recognize economic and social rights and has not even ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child is seen by others as a justification to ignore obligations and to make their own definitions of what human rights are. Another example is the reaction of the previous government here in the United Kingdom to a discussion in the UN about its policy towards children. The Conservative government refused to discuss criticism about the detention of minors and other serious problems relating to the rights of the child with the Committee on the Rights of the Child within the UN. And this attitude was supported by the newspaper, the Daily Telegraph, which headlined against the committee, "How dare they?" Many other governments, and that's perhaps especially in the development countries, are concerned about being criticized on human rights. But the risk is that they see human rights as a problem of international image, public relations, rather than a genuine problem of substance. And double speak is not unusual in this field. And we know that nowadays several governments have employed law firms or consultancy bureaus, for instance in Washington, to help them improve their image. Such activities makes it more important that both governments and human rights advocates are serious in their approach. And because the moral, the ethical dimension of the human rights cause, critics must be particularly aware of the importance of consistency, to be consistent. If you focus only on opportune targets, you will rightly be accused of selective indignation. And for the moment, as you know, China has been put in a special and protected category by almost all governments in Europe and North America. And that hardly helps the general human rights cause. I think the challenge for the human rights approach, which will determine the real impact, is whether it can protect its pure and principled character and at the same time pursue this process of mainstreaming to impact on other parts of political developments and economic developments. The progress of democracy, and many of the European North American governments talk repeatedly about the progress in that field. For instance, in Eastern Europe, Africa, Latin America, has not eradicated human rights violations. We still have them. We have human rights problems in Europe and North America itself. And we need constantly to sharpen our senses and to develop informed judgment and a sense for the distinction again between right and wrong. In this we, I'm sure, can seek inspiration from individual human rights advocates, people like Dhruv Patel.
Got time for about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour of questions, and there are two or three roving mics in the room. So anyone wants to ask a question, perhaps you wait for the mic to come to you.
The recent case of Pinochet and the removal of Lord Hoffman from the House of Lords, Law Lords, structure for judging the Pinochet case on the basis of Hoffman's connection with Amnesty International. Do you see that problem there in light of the fact that Hoffman is a law lord and has a long established relation with Amnesty International and is correspondingly should most probably be regarded as an expert in human rights law? Do you see that problem that took place with Lord Hoffman as a sort of accidental, isolated problem, or does it belie something more problematic about the academic and professional establishment?
Take a couple more, or shall we?
In this case, as in all other cases, it's important that justice is also seen to be made. And I think there might have been... I think if I had been representing Amnesty International, I would have been more careful about this aspect. And I think it's justified to be a bit self-critical on their side when it comes to this. But I don't think that actually what happened justified the decision taken. But it gave the Chileans an argument, and that should have been avoided.
Maybe we'll collect two or three questions and just respond to them.
the microphone there.
No, it doesn't
appear
to work.
Oh, isn't it?
I'm going to argue that human rights is a political idea that's above ideologies. It seems to me that human rights
is a
political
idea. What's up, girl?
I got the point.
I'm not sure everyone else up to it, so maybe it's
better. I will repeat when I
repeat.
And there was one. Yes.
How do you ever separate human rights from democracy? You spoke briefly about doublespeak in human rights. After your experience for so many years, what are some benchmarks that you might suggest to people to recognize doublespeak when we hear it and how we might combat it? I mean, I think we're confronting a situation where you have people choosing to use human rights language to protect some very bizarre so-called rights. I mean, for example, Monsanto has now decided that, you know, it's part of their natural rights to genetically engineer food.
Okay. The first one, which we didn't really heard, was whether one really could say that human rights are apolitical. I think the best formulation probably would be that they are political in the sense that they have a political impact, and that they are in the political scene, and they are at least partly also based on political thinking. But I think the point that human rights organizations are trying to make is that though it might be political, it's a principled approach to politics. Separation of human rights and democracy is not the same. There are, of course, close linkages between them. Human rights are usually better defended in democracies, and democracies usually develop in a situation where human rights are protected, but it's not the same. And I think it's actually very important to make the distinction, and especially not to believe that as soon as you have had democratic elections that the human rights problems are gone, which is one of the myths which is spread nowadays, that the sort of real solution to the problem is to organize democratic elections. And we know by experience now that it's much more complicated than that. Doublespeak, how do you identify doublespeak? It's by nature very difficult to do. If you're talking about what is said by governments in various parts of the world, one means will be to check what they are saying internally, what they're saying in their own language, what is written in their own newspapers. Usually that is quite different from what they are saying on the international scene. But when it comes to the problem you raised about the specific problem about gene manipulation and things like that, I think the only way to expose doublespeak is good journalism. Journalists are so important when it comes to protection of human rights and exposing precisely such phenomena. Yeah.
What do you think the greatest challenge will be for human rights in the next century?
Let's start all over again. Now, I don't want to answer the question, but let me point at a couple of issues that I think we have to sort of clarify for ourselves. One is the relationship between human rights protection and the new situation we have in the economic field, and the consequences of the new market economy approach that we have also in our own countries when it comes to people who are marginalized, and how we could build protection in a human rights spirit for those people.
Other problems are how you continue the discussion about justice versus national reconciliation. I'm today faced with this discussion in relation to Cambodia, where it's absolutely important for the development of this country that the Khmer Rouge leaders are put to trial. But there is a challenge against that from many people saying that this will ruin the peace in the country. That discussion will be, I think, immensely important. Another thing is to actually give the United Nations resources to begin to act for human rights, because the international regime for human rights is totally in shambles and under-resourced and badly equipped. And if we're serious about human rights, we need to give Mayor Robinson and the machinists in the United Nations some resources to begin to act. Three issues.
Some people are marginalized behind the lectern, apparently, trying to ask questions.
Well, talking about double talk, may I contribute an example which is particularly topical? Namely, the fundamentally different approach by the international community to separatism in Kosovo and to separatism in Turkey. If one looks at the way in which the Kurdish separatism have been treated by the international community and compares it to the way in which the international community handles the separatism in Kosovo, one can have a very fine example of the double talk.
Actually, there has been double talk in both cases.
Hello?
She asked about the national institutions for human rights, which is a term for ombudsmen or special commissions protecting human rights, a sort of independent structure in the society outside the political machineries. Again, the proof is the eating. I think in general, many of those national and governmentally inspired commissions have been useful. In Indonesia, for instance, we were very pessimistic when it was formed, but it has turned out to be quite useful. And there are other similar examples. And that's one trend in the building of structures when it comes to human rights. It sometimes takes its own momentum. But I think also at the same time it has to be monitored carefully, because it could also corrupt and borrow from the prestige of being an independent institution and actually serve other purposes. So I think it has to be monitored case by case. First and
I've got a question about when you get abuse of human rights, as in Afghanistan, where women are not allowed any education. It's the only country in the world doing this. And there's a lot of feeling, I think, amongst women throughout the world on this question. And though some might say it's internal, it's eventually. I'd rather Afghanistan, there's a tremendous abuse of human rights there. Women are not allowed any education, not allowed to work, locked up, forced to wear veils. It's so in contradiction to general international movements in the world which are stressing the rights of women, and some might say it is eventually the affairs of another state. What would you advise people concerned with human rights, international organisations which do deal with Afghanistan, to do about a situation of this kind? I'm interested.
Can I just quickly say my question? Basically, you mentioned the right to economic and social development and the right to development, and I was wondering your opinion of the Jubilee 2000 campaign at the moment to eradicate or erase third world debt. That's it. You said that China had been put into a special category. Could you give us some details as to why that should be so, in view of the fact that they've almost obliterated the Tibetan race?
Mm-hmm. One more. Okay. Afghanistan and women, what advice can we give to the international organization? I actually am not so critical about, for instance, UNICEF when it comes to women and Afghanistan. I think they have actually tried quite a lot and used various means to try to influence those in power there to change their attitude. This is a perfect example of the point made earlier about making a distinction between culture and what is sort of outrageous human rights violations. The treatment of women there are very, very bad, of course, and we have to continue to raise the issue and try to do that in some kind of an atmosphere of solidarity with the women in the country. But it's not an easy one, and it will take quite a long time. The problem is when such governments are established, there is a backtracking, and it would take a long time to regain the ground again. So unfortunately, I think it's realistic to be fairly pessimistic when it comes to this. Debt and human rights, I think one could argue, if one really tries to, that the heavy debt on some countries in the south has a detrimental effect on at least economic and social rights, but this is not a cause which the human rights community has raised, and the discussion about the possibilities of debt relief is not usually argued on the basis of human rights, but on development and development possibilities. When it comes to China, I think that's a very sad example. There's no doubt that ordinary dissent is squeezed in China, perhaps more than for a long time. People are imprisoned because they have stated that they would like to form peacefully a new political party, and they are sentenced to heavy sentences just because of that. And at the same time, the European Union and the United States are involved in some kind of a dialogue with China. And the purpose on the Chinese side, as you know, is partly to avoid a resolution within the Commission on Human Rights, and they probably will succeed another year when it comes to that. But the Western governments must begin to analyze what is the cost of this type of a dialogue and where is the bottom line when it comes to the usefulness of this kind of exercise. It's a good example when there is a need to be consistent. And everyone, of course, realizes that a small country with much less economic and other importance would not be treated in the same way as China. Pardon? There is a bit of a difference there. Yes. Is that all?
Do you think you can defend human rights in private spaces, like the family home or spaces where you can have contractual relationships?
This is one of the perhaps intellectually most interesting developments having taken place during the last couple of years, namely the extension of human rights into, for instance, subjects like domestic violence, where the decision is taken by the United Nations that the beating up of children or women or people within that family context will be seen as a human rights violation in the sense that the authorities should take measures to prevent such abuse to take place. It in reality doesn't mean that if a child is beaten up in a home that the United Nations would make a statement against the Tony Blair government saying that but it will start a discussion on whether there isn't a need to take some further steps also in this country to protect children against abuse. And this is another type of discussion that is coming into the human rights debate, which I think is interesting. The dilemma there, of course, is to make a clear distinction between what is a human rights violation and which are factors that affect the situation when it comes to the possibilities of respecting human rights. One more there.
Yes, I have a question according to implementation problems that maybe Anthony Giddens and Thomas Hammerberg could answer jointly. And this is basically the case of labor weapon exports to Indonesia. Increased weapon imports to Indonesia lately, and you know how you would comment on that case problem, how you implement human rights in that specific case. Whether maybe...
My chair said one more question, then we answered the two together.
Just wait for the microphone.
Hello. Yes, I have a question about the paradoxes which I think globalization is leading to within human rights. For example, just to give you a short example, it has been alleged that George Soros was in part responsible for the crash of the markets. Okay, I mean, I'm not going to get into sort of the debate on that. But at the same time, George Soros is responsible for a number of human rights projects internationally. You know, Arjen Nair, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, he has created numerous democratization projects and has worked with, in particular, from what I know personally, the Romani issue. With the rights of Roma, of gypsies in Eastern Europe. And obviously for that, he has to be commended. But again, getting to the source and the paradoxes of globalization with human rights. So you have this key player who obviously has a lot of economic power, right, and can affect markets in certain parts of the globe. And then can use the wealth generated from that to then get involved with human rights in another part of the globe. And I just thought, I think that's a very striking paradox, and I wonder if you can comment on that. Thank you.
I think that'll have to be the last two questions. Thanks very much, everybody. I'll leave the ambassador to answer them.
Thank you. I thought you were addressed at least halfly on one of them. Indonesia and weapons, I don't think I know enough about the particular case to be able to make a useful comment, but it is clear that the present policy of the weapon exporting countries do not, in my opinion, sufficiently consider the human rights impact on the sales of arms in their regulations or even the policy. You have a discussion again in Sweden about this, where of course the requirement from the human rights community is to have very strict rules, and that the burden of proof would be on the other side to show that the expert will not have a negative impact on the human rights situation. But as in several other fields, what we would like to have is a discussion about the impact on a planned policy or proposed policy when it comes to human rights, and that human rights consideration will be important when one finally decides on the policies or regulations. This will go for this area as well. This is, of course, an area where hypocrisy very easily comes out, and some politicians would stand up and say, yes, there may be some problems here, but on the other hand, we have to protect our factories and the employment for the workers who are working this, and you have to balance the risk when it comes to these weapons being badly used to the economic needs, including employment possibilities for our own people. And this is how the discussion goes. And I think the conclusion of an emphasis on human rights is to further seek guarantees that the human rights situation in the country buying the arms, importing the arms, would be considered when it comes to the decisions. Soros. Let me just say in passing that I think the treatment of the Roma population, the gypsies, is one of the areas where the Western community has to be self-critical and look at what it has done. And the xenophobia against the Roma people is quite enormous in a number of countries. Of course, mainly in Eastern Europe, but it's a common European problem that has not been addressed sufficiently, and it's good that Soros and others have raised this. When it comes to the contradiction between his charity activities and his foundations and what he actually has done when it comes to market speculation, there have been others more competent than I to make comments about that. What he writes himself in the book is that he has only stayed within the limits of the law and the actual possibilities, never violated any law when he has made his financial placements. And he has used the money deliberately, tried to build up as much funds as possible and use it deliberately for good causes. That's one approach, and I would not be the one to stand up and say he's one of the big sinners. There are more serious cases, I must say.
Well, let me thank everyone in the audience for your participation, and of course thank Mr. Hammerberg for a notable beginning to this lecture series. Thanks very much indeed.